Welcome. This is James R. Copeland, the director of the Center for Legal Policy at the Manhattan Institute. And it's my pleasure to welcome with us today the longtime president of the American Civil Liberties Union and current professor of law at New York Law School, Nadine Strossen. Professor Strossen, welcome.
I'm so delighted to be here, Jim.
We're going to be talking today about what potentially will be one of the landmark cases that those of us who've had the fortune to study in law school will study under the constitutional law framework, and that's the case challenging the recently passed Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, known by many of its detractors and some of its proponents as Obamacare in the public jargon.
And some call it Obama-Romneycare just to amplify the political points, right?
Exactly. And so we've gone through the oral arguments now at the Supreme Court, and various folks are doing tea reading through the oral arguments. We had a wonderful featured discussion on our Point of Law web magazine, which Professor Strossen was kind enough to participate in, and wanted to just ask you some follow-up questions and some clarifying questions about the oral argument and the case presented, et cetera, particularly drawn from what you contributed to our website. So the first day of these oral arguments were sort of off topic in the sense that they weren't on the actual merits of the case, but rather whether the Anti-Injunction Act served to bar the constitutional challenge to the individual mandate to buy health insurance, which is one of the main focal points for the merits of the litigation. Basically, under theory that if this were considered a tax, if the penalties related to the individual mandate were considered a tax, it wouldn't be challengeable until the tax was actually levied under the Anti-Injunction Act. So you discussed this in our online discussion. I didn't take you as being too persuaded by the argument. Can you expand on your thoughts on this part of the case a little bit?
Certainly, Jim. And for all of the disagreement among commentators and among judges, I want to stress that it's not me alone who thought that this argument was unpersuasive. That seemed to be the overall tenor of the Supreme Court itself, as indeed had been true among lower court judges. Let me be very clear that the issue that was involved was a statutory construction issue, namely whether an 1867 federal law called the Anti-Injunction Act as a statutory matter required the court to dismiss the litigation as premature. The key language in that statute bars any suit for the purpose of restraining the assessment or collection of any tax. Now, basically, the reason makes great good sense. It's that because the federal government depends on tax revenues in order to finance its operations, there should be a pay first, litigate later rule if you are talking about actual taxes. And in some respects, the minimum coverage requirement and accompanying penalty, if you don't comply with it under the health care law, could be considered to be a tax. Those pertinent provisions about collecting the penalty are included in the Internal Revenue Code. And as you know, it's collected by virtue of an offset against what would be your refund for in your tax return. Nonetheless, the court seemed to not be persuaded, as indeed none of the parties in the case argued, that this particular statutory language was designed to bar litigation of this sort. Interestingly enough, the Obama administration initially had raised this statutory, I shouldn't say defense, but deferral to the litigation to put it off, but it changed its position. And therefore, in order to get somebody to make the argument that the statute applies, the Supreme Court does what it often does in these kinds of situations, Jim, where none of the direct parties is advocating a particular position. The administration appointed a very prominent, respected private lawyer to make that argument, and he did a very workable job zealously advocating the position he had been assigned to argue. But I think I think people would be flabbergasted if the Supreme Court accepted that argument, and some are anticipating a 9-0 vote on that issue.
Fascinating. So let's go then to the heart of the argument on the individual mandate, which you talked about in your second and third posts in our discussion. And in essence, as I read what you're saying here, at least initially, you were suggesting that the challenge here is not really about liberty per se, and you, of course, were long interested in civil liberties. This is more economic liberty. It's not really about liberty, but rather Congress's power relative to the judiciary. And the latter proposition is doubtless true, but the first to me seemed a bit strange, and maybe it's because I'm one of these guys that cares about the structural constitution, but in my viewpoint, it seems like a federal government of limited powers is one of the Constitution's core bulwarks of liberty. Am I missing something?
No, you are absolutely right. I have to clarify that my post almost entirely, and perhaps entirely, I haven't reread them recently, were focused on what not only the current law, but the long-standing law has been. In other words, how the Supreme Court has interpreted the very important structural provisions in the Constitution. And I wasn't necessarily advocating how I think that should be reinterpreted. So let's start with your very important point, Jim, which I certainly agree with, and far more importantly, it is a point that has been passionately advocated in particular by Justice Anthony Kennedy, who everybody acknowledges is the key swing vote in this litigation, as he is in so many of the hotly contested cases. Specifically, that the so-called structural provisions or even pervasive themes throughout the Constitution, even reading between the lines of the specific provisions, namely dividing and separating government power, not only vertically between the national and the state levels of government, but also horizontally, the so-called separation of powers, checks and balances, among the branches of the federal or national government, that the purposes of those structural arrangements were to limit government power for the sake of maximizing individual liberty. I think that is absolutely correct, and I'm very excited that Justice Kennedy has, along with, I should say, a number of the court's respected so-called conservative justices, has really stressed that pro-individual liberty purpose of the overall design of the Constitution. That said, there are, as there have been going way back to the beginning, disagreements and counter about how to interpret the Constitution and how strongly to enforce those structural limits on government power. And as you no doubt know, and I know everybody knows just by virtue of observation, the pattern since the New Deal has really been to greatly expand the power of the national government to such an extent. I know this is old hat to you, Jim, but I think it's really worth repeating to the listeners that since 1937, there have been only two decisions in which the United States Supreme Court has held that a federal statute exceeded Congress's power under the Commerce Clause. Right. Those two were decided by a very deeply split 5-4 margin. And even after those two decisions, Justices Kennedy and Scalia seemed to retreat in the next case that presented that issue. So you don't have very many precedents, for many, many decades now, in which the Supreme Court has decided that it's important to protect individual liberty, protect state autonomy by limiting Congress's power under the Commerce Clause. And I think it's really important for folks to understand from that perspective how radical it would be for the Supreme Court to strike down the minimum coverage provision of this law. That doesn't necessarily mean it's right or wrong, but it means that it would be certainly undoing a long shared understanding of what the Congress's power is. And I should also add, Jim, what the Supreme Court's power is. So we're not talking about cutting back on the power of the federal government, per se. We would be talking about shifting that power from the Congress, the president, the democratically elected branches of the federal government to an unelected, unaccountable branch of the federal government, the Supreme Court.
I mean, doesn't that hinge to some degree what you mean by power? Because, of course, the judiciary here would have the power to override the Congress under this type of theory. But when I worry about government power, I worry about the power of the government over the individual here. And the premise here would be to limit the assertion of power by Congress, right? I mean, so clearly there's an interbranch.
Right? I completely agree with the first part of your statement, with your premise, but not with the conclusion. And here's where civil libertarians, and I know economic libertarians, of which I have many, many friends, both at your institution and the Cato Institute and others, where we tend to disagree a bit. And that is that, from my perspective, I really don't care which branch of government is infringing on my rights. If I consider it to be a fundamental right, I don't care whether it is being inflicted by Congress or whether it's being inflicted by the state of New York or any other state. And that's why I emphasized in my second, and I think that's the common sense, quite frankly, perspective on liberty. I think most people just talk about government power in general versus individual rights and could care less whether it's the state, their state government or their local government or the national government, or for that matter, an international government that's restricting their liberty. So I really wanted to bring to folks' attention that those who were most ardently opposing Congress's power to pass the law, or at least the minimum coverage requirement, we're equally strongly arguing that it would be completely within the power of any state government, as Massachusetts has done, to pass that same kind of provision, that there would be no argument against that under either a state or a federal constitution. And from my perspective, as an individual rights advocate, who really dislikes big centralized government bureaucracies, I think it's also important to point out that the opponents of this particular health care law were arguing that it would have been completely constitutional to have a completely centralized national bureaucracy, a national health care system, the so-called single-payer option that ironically during the political debates was being advocated by the most left-wing segments of the public and of the Democratic Party, but was seen as being too socialistic by the Obama administration and many centrist Democrats. So that's why I think, at least as the public understands these concepts, we're not really talking about individual liberty versus government power, or a big government program versus a small government program.
No, I totally get that point, and these things do get conflated to some degree in the mindset of the public who hasn't been to law school and what have you. But I do think that, because you suggested in your third post, well, this was sort of would be a return to Lochner era jurisprudence, and I sort of said, well, hold on a minute, because there's the actual Lochner jurisprudence and its progeny, which said, well, under a liberty of contract theory, New York can't pass a minimum hour law or maximum hour law for bakers, but the other line of Commerce Clause jurisprudence, sort of the Schechter poultry line, throwing out under the Commerce Clause the National Industrial Recovery Act and what have you, would really be what this would fit into. And I completely agree with you. There's a difference between sort of a fundamental rights analysis, freedom of speech, criminal procedure, and these sorts of economic questions. But to me, it seems like the structural constitution might be the right way to handle the economic questions, because if we don't like what Massachusetts is doing on its healthcare market, we can move to New Hampshire. Obviously, there's certain fundamental rights, free speech, criminal procedure, basic equal protection of the laws and what have you, that we don't want any state, any level of the government to abrogate those rights. And I think that's an important part of our jurisprudence. But this is sort of trying to bring back, at least on a limited basis and sort of an outer bounds basis, a limit on the federal government's economic regulatory power. I mean, wouldn't you say that there's an important distinction there?
I agree with, I'll qualify it to say just about everything you said in case I didn't get every nuance there, but I think we're using the term Lochner and Lochner era in two different ways, and you were using it absolutely in the technically correct sense of referring to a group of Supreme Court decisions that read into the 14th Amendment guarantee of liberty. Government may not deprive any of us of liberty without due process of law. Reading into that, this implied judicially created liberty of contract that it then used to strike down economic and social regulations. However, I'm using the term Lochner era in a more general sense, the way it is often used to connote what is now under the conventional wisdom. That doesn't mean that it's right, but again, I want to emphasize the conventional wisdom since 1937 has been during that period, whether under that particular line of cases or under the Commerce Clause cases, the court was engaging in undue judicial activism, unduly, and as a super legislature, as its detractors described it, that whether it was striking down congressional legislation under an unduly narrow reading of the Commerce Clause, or whether it was striking down state legislation under this judicially created liberty of contract right that it, the court created under the 14th or 5th Amendment due process clauses, that in either case, what linked together the flaws of that approach was inflating judicial power at the expense of the democratically elected branches of government. So that's what they have in common. I completely agree with you, Jim, that that leaves open the question, well, just because the court was incorrect under conventional wisdom in creating a liberty of contract, maybe it was not incorrect in having a limited view of the Commerce Clause. But again, I want to say I think that that would be rolling back a lot of precedent. And I do hear what you're saying, that and this is why I think there was so much emphasis in the briefs and the oral arguments challenging the law, that this kind of regulation is different, never before. And that's why using words carefully, as all advocates do, the opponents and critics of the central minimum coverage provision refer to it as an individual mandate, because they are trying to stress the notion that this is actual government compulsion to individuals obtain some services that they otherwise would not, to obtain some product that they otherwise would not, and arguably that's something that has never been done before. I disagree with that characterization, but I think that's really where the fight is going to come down.
Well, that's wonderful. It's been a real pleasure having you with us, Professor. Again, this has been James Cope, one of the Manhattan Institute Center for Legal Policy, with Nadine Strossen, Professor of Law at New York Law School and the longtime president of the American Civil Liberties Union. Fascinating discussion, shedding a lot of light on this challenge to the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Jim.